This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock. This week we're going to investigate attempts by the fossil fuel industry to capture otherwise green-thinking ports in the Pacific Northwest of the United States and Canada to export carbon to Asia. It's a battle you hardly hear about. Citizens are lining up against huge corporations with huge money to fight off giant coal ports, liquefied natural gas ports, even propane ports. If we commit to that infrastructure, we commit to devastating climate change, not to mention the explosive, toxic, and polluting impacts of these big projects on the Pacific coast, its species, and its people. We'll first hear from activist Kevin Washbrook, reporting from Vancouver, Canada, and then from Green Radio host and activist Daphne Wysham from Portland, Oregon. I'll wrap up with some new science presented at a Harvard University research talk. Dr. James Anderson presents why climate change is coming much faster than anyone thought possible and why it cannot be reversed. It's EcoShocking Radio. I'm Alex Smith. Let's roll. Multinational corporations would like to turn the gorgeous port of Vancouver, Canada, into another fossil fuel colony after coal port proposals were blocked by a public outcry in the American Pacific Northwest. They want to ship coal out to Asia through Vancouver. There's an active proposal to steer dirty tar sands oil into hundreds of tankers through Vancouver's scenic inlets. Even liquid natural gas is trying to use Vancouver as an outlet. We've reached activist Kevin Washbrook in Vancouver. He's part of the group Voters Taking Action on Climate Change, or VTAC. Kevin, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. Nice to be here.
Let's talk about coal. How big is the export business from Vancouver?
Well, right now we have two fully functioning coal ports, one in North Vancouver, Neptune Terminal, which exports exclusively BC metallurgical coal from the Kootenays, and then West Shore Terminals in Tsawwassen, which is the biggest coal port in Canada, and depending on, you know, who's exporting more, it's often the biggest or the busiest coal port in North America. Neptune exports around, you know, they export around 6 million tons of coal a year. They're trying to expand that to larger volumes. West Shore exports in the order of 30 to 33 million tons of coal a year, and about 8 million tons of that coal is U.S. thermal coal from the Powder River Basin.
Wow. So they truck it all, or they train it all the way up from Wyoming, I guess it is.
It is. And so it comes on Warren Buffett's BNSF Railroad up through Semiahmoo First Nation, White Rock, Crescent Beach, all along the water through there, and then up through around Mud Bay and over to West Shore Terminals.
Why aren't they using American coal ports?
Well, that's a good question. There were plans for six coal ports on the U.S. West Coast as recently as, you know, 3 or 4 years ago. And all about two of those projects have either been completely have been rejected or abandoned. And the last two, the one in Oregon on the Columbia River, faces serious difficulties because it's failed to receive key permits. The last project and the largest at Cherry Point in Washington, so just south of the border, also faces serious opposition, including from the Lummi Nation, which has said outright, we reject this, you're not going to build it. So public outcry, public opposition, and really strong community organizing in the states has stopped all these projects. So that leaves BC, you know, it's sort of the back door or the dirty doormat for U.S. coal on its way to Asia. And so right now they have been exporting this 7 million tons a year for some time, or 7 to 8 million tons. By way of comparison, the Cherry Point coal port proposal in Bellingham would be about 48 million tons of coal a year. And there is this new proposal to build a brand new coal port on the Fraser River in Surrey to export exclusively American coal, 4 million tons now, probably more in the future.
Great. So what problems do coal trains pose for local communities?
Well, yeah, that's a good point, too, because and especially in BC and in Metro Vancouver, because we have this port authority that has, you know, it's a federal agency. It's sort of almost like a crown corporation, but it's also a regulator. It has absolute power over decision-making on port lands, and that's the land basically all along the waterline in Metro Vancouver. So they can approve a coal port, but they take no responsibility for the external impacts that generates, and the one you're mentioning now is key, coal trains. So coal trains going through communities, you know, they're extremely loud, and they often travel at night, and the noise levels from these things are over 100 decibels when the whistles are going. And that exceeds, you know, the World Health Organization says nighttime noise levels should be below 30 decibels for young people, for the elderly, for the sick. There's noise. There's also vibration, and you know that there's problems in White Rock with the cliff faces slumping because of the vibration. There's also a lot of concern over coal dust. You know, we don't know how much coal dust is lost from these trains, and we don't know what the health impacts of long-term exposure to low levels of particulate are from the dust. So that's an issue. One of the biggest concerns is diesel exhaust. We know diesel exhaust is a carcinogen. Diesel particulate is a carcinogen. And these trains run, you know, within a kilometer of a number of schools and daycares and senior centers. They're already running now, and the plan is to run more of them. So people are rightly concerned about all those local impacts.
How have activists raised Vancouver's dirty coal profile in the media there?
Yeah, it's been an interesting process. You know, well, in the fall of 2012, a community member in Surrey told me about these two proposals, the expansion at Neptune and the new coal port in Surrey at Fraser Surrey Docks. And when I looked at the numbers, if you added up all the proposed capacity, if all of that coal is exported, it would be more global warming pollution than, you know, the Northern Gateway pipeline. It's a huge, huge issue, but it's all piecemeal and it was under the radar. So over the past 2.5 years, we've managed to raise the profile immensely. Our organization and a group based in Surrey called Communities in Coal and Dogwood Initiative and others. And it's been an interesting process of working with local governments one by one, getting them on board about the issues, having them call or put forward motions calling for, you know, proper public assessment or health risk assessment of these projects. We eventually presented before Metro Vancouver, and the region eventually opposed this coal port in Surrey outright. Various health leaders, you know, climate scientists, community leaders have all come out saying they're opposed to this. Everything from the BC Nurses Union to Van City Credit Union to the Fishermen's Union to, you know, all sorts of groups have said this is a bad idea. So, you know, we've held various rallies and events, and we've presented at the Port Authority AGM, and it's really a simple issue. You know, we're saying the Port Authority can't make decisions that affect our future as a region without including us in those decisions. And they're an extremely arrogant and remote organization. So, the contrast is so stark that I think media understands this and the broader public gets that. You know, you can't do things like this anymore. It's you know, the 19th century, and they're not, you know, captains of industry. We're a democratic society.
Yeah, NASA scientist James Hansen famously was arrested protesting mountaintop removal for coal. But in Vancouver, I was tracking Simon Fraser University professor and world energy expert Mark Jacquard was arrested blocking a coal train. So it sounds like you are getting significant buy-in there.
Yeah, it's a pretty compelling story because it's a very stark one. You know, we know that we need to radically reduce the use of fossil fuels to avoid dangerous climate change. And one study after another is coming out saying that, you know, we can probably burn a bit more of the oil and a bit more of the gas, but we absolutely can't burn more coal. You know, 80% or more of coal has to remain in the ground if we're going to avoid blowing past any sort of safe thresholds for climate change. And if that's the case, and I believe it's true based on everything I've read, then there is simply no valid argument for building a new coal port anywhere in the world. Because once you build it, they're going to want to use it, right? So it's very black and white for me. Not many things are in life, but this is very black and white. A new coal port in Surrey is a bad idea. U.S. thermal coal exports through Metro Vancouver is a bad idea. And it's something that's worth standing up and saying no to, saying, I don't think this is right.
Trying to stop fossil fuel exports is like playing the game whack-a-mole. You find one project, then another one pops up, like the recent proposal to ship out liquid natural gas via the historic Fraser River. Tell us what's happening there.
Well, that's another interesting thing. What's kind of most interesting about this team, I guess I should say most frustrating, is that there's no real effort by government to make people aware of these things. You know, I literally stumbled across this proposal because I was on the BC Environmental Assessment Project or Office website, and there's a new proposal recently posted from this U.S. company, Westpac Midstream, to build an LNG terminal on the Fraser. And if you know where to look, if you go there, you can see that and you can make comment. But if you don't know, you're not going to find out. And the government doesn't go along the Fraser and, you know, put up things on billboards or on telephone poles and say, are you concerned about this? The federal government has given us from, you know, so this proponent, when they realize their project is a certain size, they have to let the BC and federal governments know. And the governments have to decide to do an assessment or not. So Ottawa, you know, in its wisdom, on May the 22nd said, okay, we'll accept comments from the public until June the 11th to help us decide if we should even do an assessment or not. And furthermore, if we should substitute a provincial assessment for the federal one. So if you didn't go to the CEA website, the Canadian Environmental Assessment Agency website, and see that notice, you would never have even known that there was a comment period. It's very frustrating because, you know, these are big things and we all need to have a say. So anyways, to back up to the proposal, this is a plan for a brand new LNG terminal on the Fraser River in Delta, BC, next to the two cement plants that are across the river and just upstream from, if you know, Richmond, there's sort of a place called Watermania and a big movie complex and all that sort of stuff. It would see 120 LNG tankers a year and 90 LNG barges a year going up and down the Fraser River. Now, in comparison, some people are somewhat more aware of this proposal for wood fiber LNG in Squamish. It's had a lot of press. This proposal in the Fraser would be 1.5 times as large. Also in comparison, the big Petronas Pacific Energy LNG project in Prince Rupert would be about 7 times larger. So this is a fairly small project, but it would still see a lot of LNG tankers on the river. The proponent, and this to me is typical, the project summary description, it says, we want to build this facility, this is the footprint, we're going to look at endangered plants and archaeological sites and whatnot right here, but once we sell that LNG and it goes onto an LNG tanker, it's someone else's responsibility. We're not going to assess those risks. That's crazy, you know, that's absolutely crazy. And in the United States, if you want to build an LNG terminal, the Department of Homeland Security and the Coast Guard require that you conduct a waterway suitability assessment on the entire tanker route out to international waters to a distance of 3.5 kilometers on each side, because that's how far, you know, an unignited cloud of LNG vapor can travel and still be explosive. In BC, that doesn't happen. And there's no one asking the fundamental question, is it a good idea to build an LNG terminal in the Fraser River? They're just simply, let's look and see if this will endanger plants or salmon or sturgeon at the site of the facility. It's a very narrow, blinkered approach to assessing these kinds of projects.
Wait a minute. You're saying that a cloud can come off of one of those tankers if they were to leak that would go 3.5 kilometers, possibly on either side of the river, into an area where millions of people live?
Yeah, no, that's okay. So let me back up and qualify that. So in the United States, there is a thing called Sandia National Laboratory, S-A-N-D-I-A, and they conducted a study in the mid-2000s that said, you know, how are we going to assess the risks from LNG tankers and what sort of guidelines are we going to create to assess these things? So they said, what's the worst-case scenario? Well, the worst-case scenario is, you know, an intentional rupture of containment of all the LNG vessels on a tanker from something like a terrorist attack or an explosion. So in that worst-case scenario, what hazards would be created? And so they said, well, within 500 meters, you know, everything would be burned to a crisp. And up to 1,600 meters, you'd have burn hazards and freezing hazards and these things, and they would decline over distance. But if that cloud of LNG, if that LNG didn't ignite right away, as it evaporates and turns to gas, before it disperses, it can still be a risk of producing a fireball up to 3.5 kilometers away. So for that worst case scenario, we're going to require that LNG proponents examine the risks all along that 3.5 kilometer route. And we want to know if there are people living there, if there are, you know, if there's significant infrastructure there, if there are, all sorts of any sort of property or public health and safety risks. Because, you know, in the States they say you got to explicitly examine the possibility of a terrorist attack, you've got to look at the worst case scenario, you've got to see what could happen if one of these things went badly wrong while en route. So that's smart to me. You know, you want to know what the risks are before you approve these things, before a port or whoever approves them. In Canada, there is no such requirement. And all they're looking at here is the footprint of this facility. And it's, to me, that's quite frightening because, you know, I am no supporter of the Harper government, but I do know that they say that the risk of terrorist threats is real on our soil. Well, if that's the case, then why aren't you looking at the risks from transporting an extremely volatile substance in these vessels through highly populated areas? That just makes sense.
Well, now, Kevin Washbrook, we know there are quite a few environmentally conscious voters in the Vancouver region. Do you worry, though, that your work to stop these proposals will push fossil fuels further north along the coast to Squamish or to northern ports like Prince Rupert or Kitimat?
That's an interesting question. I don't think so. I think, you know, those projects in the north, local people there are going to make their own assessment. I mean, I know what my thoughts are in terms of the risks to the climate from LNG, in terms of what groups like the CCPA and the Pembina Institute have figured out. But local populations are going to weigh and assess the local risks themselves, and I respect their ability to do that and their interest in doing that. I think what's going on here is that, you know, people down here are very aware that there are these big projects proposed up north, whether it's LNG or, you know, bitumen pipelines, and we often don't feel like we can have any sort of say in this kind of future for BC. But in fact, Metro Vancouver, we really are on the front lines of the fossil fuel debate, export debate, because we have proposals for the Kinder Morgan pipeline, we've got proposal for a new coal port, now we have a proposal for the LNG on the Fraser and the LNG in Squamish. So people realize there's a lot at stake here, and they are, and it's more accessible when it's here. You know, you can have more of a say, you can get engaged in the debate, and you can learn more about it. So I don't think it'll push things away. I think there's so many companies trying to push forward so many projects at once that, like you said, it's a bit of a whack-a-mole. They're going to pop up wherever they feel like there's a possibility.
Where does your group, Voters Taking Action on Climate Change, find most of its support? Do young people show up, just older folks? Tell us about your supporters.
That's, it's interesting. So, you know, most of our work is done online, really. We engage with the public through email, through social media. When we do events, I mean, we always work with other groups when we do events, too, so it's harder to say who's coming from where, but it really is a cross-section. There's a lot of older, concerned folks, and there's also a lot of young people. We work a lot with a group called Kids for Climate Action on events, and they draw out a sort of a high school audience. I think the concern is widespread, whether it's because you're worried about, you know, the local environment or whether you're worried about your future. There's something to be concerned about here for everyone, I guess, for all ages.
And so, VTAC, what do you think other communities, say, in the United States or in Britain or elsewhere, could learn from the way your group has formed and operated?
Well, interesting. I think, you know, our whole focus is trying to create opportunities for the public to express their concern to government. And we try and connect the dots between climate policy and fossil fuel exports that put our climate at risk, because climate policy discussions are often pretty abstract. Like the thing that's happened recently with the Harper government saying that they agree to eliminate fossil fuel use by 2100. Well, 84 years from now, no one's going to be here who's alive now, and that's just an absurd abstract discussion when we have real projects right here, right now, that are threatening our climate. So I think creating opportunities for the public to engage and express their concerns are key, and you know, we do that a lot through public commenting websites. Like right now for the LNG thing, we've set up a website called reallnghearings.org, and that brings together all the information on the Fraser River LNG proposal, and there's a commenting tool, so you can send a message directly to the Federal Environment Minister, and it's CC'd to local government. So my experience is that people care, and they want to take action. You know, they may think that they don't know how, or they don't have the time, so you create an opportunity, you put all the information in one place, and people want to act. I guess just empowering people, that's the key, empowering people.
Can you give us your website address or your Facebook page?
Sure. Our website is vtacc.org. That's our website. But the key, where we're really focusing right now, is on LNG, and so that's through reallnghearings.org.
Great. Thank you so much. Our guest, Kevin Washbrook, is an activist in Vancouver, Canada, as part of the group Voters Taking Action on Climate Change. I appreciate your time, Kevin.
You're welcome. Take care, Alex.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. What is happening on the U.S. West Coast where fossil fuel companies race to export carbon to Asia? Let's tune in with a longtime friend of the environment, Daphne Wisham. For 8 years out of Washington, D.C., Daphne hosted the syndicated radio show Earthbeat on the Pacifica Network. Her articles have been published by both mainstream and alternative media. Now Daphne is in Portland, Oregon, as the director of the Climate and Energy Program at the Center for Sustainable Economy. At the same time, she's an associate fellow at the Institute for Policy Studies. Daphne, it's so good to hear your voice again on Radio EcoShock. Welcome back.
Thanks so much, Alex. It's great to be here.
You and I were just on Post-Carbon Radio on KWMR in Northern California with Bing Gong and Karen Nyhus. It was a wide-ranging talk. I'd like, in this instance, to drill down to what's happening in Portland, the state of Oregon, maybe the Pacific Northwest. when it comes to transporting fossil fuels. Are you up for that?
I sure am.
All right. Why don't we start with Portland? What battles have been fought there recently against becoming a dirty carbon outlet?
Well, one thing that people may not realize is that not only is Portland, Oregon, a very hip city, it also happens to be one of the first cities, the first city in the United States to put in place a climate action plan. Back in the early 1990s, Portland decided that it really needed to take the climate crisis seriously. And as a result, the city has largely been ahead of the curve for the rest of the country and has a reputation, in fact, was recognized by the White House as a so-called climate champion just last December. Despite this reputation, or perhaps in addition to this reputation, the mayor decided that it was going to be a good idea to invite one of the biggest tar sands pipeline operators in the Canadian tar sands, Pembina Pipeline Corporation, to set up shop in Portland's harbors. And they wanted to export propane from the terminals here in Portland. He welcomed them with open arms. A lot of us began to organize, cried foul. And at the time of this interview, we seem to have won. We're reluctant to completely declare victory because this corporation has bottomless pockets and is doing all it can to fight back. But we waged a campaign both based on both safety issues and climate issues and generated thousands of letters and had very creative involvement from a wide array of folks here in the city, including raging grannies and bicyclist activists and people taking over city council hearings. And we finally got our message across, and it appears that Pembina is not going to be welcome anymore in the city of Portland. We want to use this victory, though, not just to say not in our backyard, but also to alert people to just how insane it is to be pushing forward with fossil fuel infrastructure in the Pacific Northwest, given the imperative that we begin to ratchet down our overall greenhouse gas emissions, not only in the Northwest, but globally. And to draw attention to the fact that the Pacific Northwest right now is in the crosshairs of the fossil fuel industry. They want to export 5 times the carbon that is now being proposed for the Keystone XL pipeline through our ports in Oregon and Washington. And very few people are aware of just how serious this hazard is to our economy, to our beautiful rivers and lakes and forests outside of the Northwest. Of course, here we're all up in arms and trying to take on one proposal after another as it comes down the pike. So rather than just playing whack-a-mole, which is sort of what a lot of groups have been doing, you stop one project, it pops up another place. We've decided to declare a ban on all new fossil fuel infrastructure, starting in Portland and then moving out to the rest of Oregon and the rest of the Northwest. And we should be getting a hearing over the coming year by city officials around this call. We want no fossil fuel exports and no new fossil fuel infrastructure in the city. So that's our campaign, and I think we have a pretty good chance of winning it.
Yeah, it would be such a different story if you were exporting solar panels in bulk or wind machines.
Sure. Yeah. I mean, we would love to be doing something along those lines. And in fact, that's the vision that Portland's climate action plan today calls for, which is, you know, again, way ahead of the curve, trying to push for bikeable and walkable cities, drastically reducing greenhouse gas emissions, increasing public transit. So it just doesn't make sense. We found that the emissions from just this one propane terminal alone over several decades would be larger than the entire city of Portland's emissions if our emissions were to continue to go down. So it just didn't make sense from a climate action perspective to be proceeding with this terminal.
Right. It's almost like changing your light bulbs at home but allowing a coal plant to be built next door. So as you know, billionaire Warren Buffett is having a hard time finding a place to unload his coal trains for shipping to China. What have you heard about new coal ports in the Pacific Northwest?
Well, you know, there have been quite a few proposals for coal export terminals in the Pacific Northwest, and almost all of them have been defeated. We have two that are still on the table, one in Longview, Washington, and one in Cherry Point. Both are for over 40 million tons of coal exports per year. The one in Cherry Point, Washington, is on Native American land, on Lummi land, and they are fighting and waging a very fierce battle against that coal export terminal because they argue that it would violate their treaties and would affect their fisheries. The other proposals that have been tabled are up and down the Columbia River have been withdrawn essentially by the investors over the past 5 years. It may have to do with the fact that coal increasingly has become less and less profitable. We also suspect it has something to do with the fact that these very same terminals began to look attractive for oil export. As soon as we get rid of a coal terminal, an oil terminal is proposed. In fact, the largest oil terminal in the entire United States is being proposed right across the river from Portland in the city of Vancouver, Washington. And that battle is now being waged between, on the one hand, there's a plan for a major development right on the riverfront that a lot of people are very excited to see happen with, you know, condominiums and businesses right along the river. And should this oil terminal get built there, that project will not go forward. So there's a lot of tension between those two different types of development that are being proposed. But, you know, over and over again, these oil, gas, and coal corporations are using very sneaky tactics. They'll claim, for example, one of the ways that an oil company managed to get the Bakken crude managed to be exported along the Columbia River, they got a port claiming it was going to be used as a biorefinery. The biorefinery went bankrupt. And then once they had already gotten the code amended for the biorefinery, they changed it to an oil terminal. So there's all sorts of tricky schemes that these industries are using, outright lies, claiming that they are, you know, for example, in the case of the propane terminal, they claimed it was going to be used for, you know, women to cook with in Asia. We found out, in fact, it was going to be used to be making propylene and plastics. Had nothing to do with alleviating the poverty of poor women in Asia. So, you know, we have to be on our guard against these companies. They're using every strategy they can. Oregon apparently is number three nationally as a target for ALEC funds. That's one of the right-wing anti-environmental and climate denialist groups that's been pushing a very strong legislative agenda in favor of big energy and big oil. And so we're really fighting on all fronts here in the Northwest.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. I mean, whenever big oil money comes into an area, there's a chance for corruption, and certainly you can woo politicians with the ideas of more jobs and a better economy. And eventually, I wonder, is it even compatible with local democracy and freedom in your area to allow these companies to come in and start working the way you're describing?
Well, that's the big threat, I think, that's looming for our region. Is, you know, it potentially will change not just the political nature of this region, but, you know, the entire economy is shaped in a completely different direction when you start welcoming in oil trains and coal trains and terminals and refineries. Suddenly you start looking a lot more like Texas than Oregon, both politically and environmentally. And that's certainly not what a lot of people move to the Pacific Northwest to experience, and those aren't the values of the Northwest. But, you know, we have, in addition to the traditional political concerns, there's also, of course, the concerns that Native Americans have around preserving their treaties, a concern as they go to court and try to get these treaties upheld. For Native Americans is that in some cases, if they lose, their treaties get weakened. So it's at great risk that they go to court and try to get these treaties upheld. And that's another potential setback that, unfortunately, once again, Native Americans have an awful lot to lose in these battles.
This is Radio EcoShock with our guest, the longtime Green Radio host and activist Daphne Weisham. Another big fad, you know, Daphne, is to announce massive liquid natural gas terminals. We've got a government in British Columbia that got elected promising all the jobs and the money and our budget would be totally balanced once we get these LNG plants, which have not materialized, incidentally. What about LNG in the Pacific Northwest?
Well, that's another big battle that we're facing right now. We've got two major pipelines being proposed just for Oregon, one in southern Oregon that they want to build. It's over $7 billion, a $7 billion pipeline that they want to build through the southern part of Oregon and then have the export terminal export LNG from Coos Bay, Oregon, and another one in northern Oregon, in Warrenton, Oregon. And both of these projects would involve, of course, massive acreage and land, a lot of it in private hands. And in many cases, they are claiming eminent domain as an argument in favor of, for example, paying about $12,000, $13,000 per acre, which is way below market value to landholders. And the irony in this is that many of these LNG companies are actually foreign-owned, and they're claiming eminent domain, which is, of course, for export. So a lot of people that are resisting these LNG terminals are saying, you know, how can they possibly be using a law that was created to develop infrastructure for people in the United States, taking our land away from us, in order to facilitate the profits of foreign corporations that are just bypassing all of our legal structures in order to build this pipeline and export it to other countries. So there's a lot of resistance, but again, with so much money on the table, a lot of politicians are lining up to support this. And certainly our local paper, The Oregonian, seems to be completely in the pocket of the fossil fuel industry. They've written editorials saying that climate change is not a concern for Oregonians and are regularly trumpeting all the benefits of these fossil fuel exports. So we're in a bit of a war here in the Northwest in terms of both keeping people informed about what's really happening and taking, you know, holding our elected officials accountable.
Does the state of Oregon allow fracking?
No, it has not banned fracking. This actually did come up this year, that there was a bill that originally was going to ban fracking, and then it sort of morphed into regulating fracking, and that created a huge uproar where people said, no, we don't want to regulate it, we want to ban it outright. Currently, there, as far as I know, there's very little in the way of any sort of gas, exploitable gas reserves anywhere in Oregon, but I think they would have an awfully hard time fracking in Oregon.
Well, that's good to hear. Now, Daphne, I know you continue to keep track of U.S. national policy as well. What do you make of President Obama taking, you know, he talks strongly about climate change, and then he approves exploration for more fossil fuels in the fragile Arctic by Shell Oil?
You know, your guess is as good as mine, Alex. I'm just mystified, you know, how he can take, especially of late in his last 2 years in office, where I think he's felt much more free to speak boldly about the climate crisis and seems to be taking an awful lot of opportunities to speak out on it, why he would, on the one hand, take these actions to, for example, restrict coal-fired power plant emissions and increase energy efficient, fuel-efficient automobiles, and then at the same time allow for Arctic drilling and massive oil and gas and coal exports. I suppose it may have something to do with the fact that he was the number one recipient of BP funds when he was running for office. I don't know if he's still feeling beholden to his donors. It's really hard to understand why he is acting the way he is.
And again, on the international front, I was disappointed the leaders of the industrial countries, the G7, could only promise an end to carbon emissions by the end of this century, 85 years away. That's way too late to avoid catastrophic climate change. What do you think?
That's right. I mean, we had a proposal that was the Germans of the G7 were trying to get a decarbonization of all of the G7 economies by 2050. And the Canadians and the Japanese pushed back, allegedly, and said, no, but we will sign on to decarbonization by 2100. Of course, this is a non-binding agreement, so even if it were 2050, it wouldn't be all that exciting, but 2100 is so far out, you know, past the lifetime of any of these folks at the table, that I'm sure they felt very comfortable making this agreement and kicking the can down the road. The Japanese apparently are very heavily invested in coal-fired power in Asia, and so that explains their reluctance to see any decrease in their investments in coal. And I suppose the Canadians, due to the tar sands, are reluctant to see decarbonization anytime soon. But you seem to suggest, at least in our last conversation, that tar sands profits are plummeting. Is that right?
That's true. It's just too expensive to produce the tar sands. You need at least $60 to $70 a barrel to do it, and they're only getting about $40 to $45. They don't get world prices because the tar sands requires so much work at the refinery to get a usable product that they get a lower price. So they're losing some money, and what's happening is there's massive layoffs in Alberta, and I mean big, big, big layoffs, and the financing for these companies is getting hard to get. And their stocks, according to one of our guests, went down 70%. So that's a big drop in their stock value as well.
Interesting. Well, that may explain why they're trying to some of the same companies tap into the fracked gas in Alberta and the propane byproduct of fracked gas that in the past had been treated as a waste gas. It's another revenue stream for them.
Yeah. Now, do you expect much concrete to come out of the Paris climate talks later this year?
Well, I'm always hopeful. I have to say I haven't been. I went to the climate negotiations in Kyoto, and I went to several others after that, and I haven't been to the last few years because I was just feeling very discouraged about all of the brinksmanship, and which is what you always see at these conferences. Nobody shows their hand until long after midnight on the final night, and then finally everybody's scrambling on very little sleep to come up with an agreement. And it just seemed like a game of chess with the fate of the planet at stake over and over again. I found it very tiresome. This time, you know, we do have China coming to the table with an agreement with the United States that does seem to have potentially at least broken a logjam between the developing countries and the wealthy countries that we saw over and over again played out at the climate negotiations. So it seems that the dynamics could be different enough to potentially shift things moving forward. But whether we'll see the kind of truly dramatic commitments that are needed to stabilize the climate anytime soon, I'm not that hopeful, but I do think that things will at least begin to shift at this next set of talks.
Now, America has elections coming up eventually. Do you expect the same rogues gallery of Republican climate deniers to be elected again in Congress?
I think the Republicans have a very slim chance of gaining the presidency. I think that they have a higher likelihood of retaining control of the Senate and the House. When you have somebody like Hillary Clinton running for office, I think, you know, just given her stature nationally and globally, she probably stands a greater chance than any of the other candidates that are running, but a lot could happen between now and 2016. That's my prediction at this point in time. We're also seeing Bernie Sanders surprisingly gaining on Hillary Clinton. He's an independent and a self-proclaimed socialist, so that's a huge surprise for the United States. I think what it suggests is that people have had enough of either candidate really avoiding the issue of income inequality, and Bernie Sanders is taking on the corporations and the banks like no other candidate is right now.
Yeah, I remember after the financial crash that Bernie Sanders actually came out and described who runs America, and it was revealing. He talked for hours and hours and hours on the record. It was great stuff. Well, I see that scientists say climate change will look very different from region to region, and we saw that again this year in North America with a hot, exceptionally dry west and a cool, snowy or rainy east. Is it a big problem that citizens experience climate change so locally, and yet the problem demands a global solution?
Well, I mean, in terms of the Pacific Northwest, one of the things that we are preparing for, which is a little bit alarming, is a major influx of climate refugees to the Northwest. City officials tell us that they're expecting, you know, the population of Portland, for example, to increase by several hundred thousand in the coming decades. So I think, you know, as California dries up and continues to dry up, we probably will see quite a few people moving north from California to wetter climates. Is it problematic how climate change plays out with regard to, I don't fully understand what you mean by that question. Can you reframe?
Well, it's just that, you know, the old story about the elephant, people come up the elephant and one pulls the tail and says, that's what an elephant looks like. And the other one grabs an ear and says, that's what the elephant looks like. Climate change is kind of like that. You know, you have people who see and experience things so differently right around them. And yet they're supposed to all unite somehow and demand an overall great big solution.
Well, I mean, I think the polls suggest that a majority of Americans do think that the climate crisis is serious, it's happening, and they want to see action taken on it. So regardless of how it manifests in their region, I think people are increasingly alarmed and are increasingly wanting to see elected officials take action. Unfortunately, our elected officials are, you know, largely following the money, and most of the money is with the Koch brothers and the other oil companies. So they're listening to them and not to the American people, at least at the moment, you know, and this is one reason why we need better campaign finance laws in this country. But I think what we've come to the conclusion here at the Center for Sustainable Economy is that working at the city level, working at the state level, you can get a lot more done than you can trying to work in Washington, D.C. Things are very broken in Washington, but you can actually affect policy at the state level, and eventually, hopefully, you can piece that into some sort of national strategy.
That's a great point. Are you getting re-energized by regional activism on the West Coast versus the politics of living and working in Washington, D.C.?
Oh, yes, yes. Lots and lots of exclamation points after that statement. I am so inspired by so many of the young people, the retirees. The level of engagement here in the Northwest around the issue of climate change is so broad and so sincere and so energized. It's really inspiring to see. A lot of people have literally, you know, just put their careers completely on hold and are doing nothing but working on this climate crisis. One of the people that's leading the local 350 chapter here in Portland is a former MD who just decided this is where she needed to spend her time and energy. I know a lot of people that have dealt with either early retirement or are living very frugally so that they can devote a significant amount of their time to working on fighting the fossil fuel industry here in Oregon. So it's both inspiring and encourages me to work even harder, whereas back in Washington, D.C., you would just feel that no matter how much you threw your head against that wall, you would just keep smashing it over and over again, and it wasn't going to budge. But things do actually get done at the state level.
I wonder if there's a story or experience beyond that that you think could help raise our listeners to an even greater move into climate activism.
Well, I mean, I think the climate crisis, as you know, you've covered it so well, especially in your recent shows with climate psychologists and others talking about the ways in which we turn away from just how serious it is. It can have that result, but it can also, when you are working in coalition with others, what I found is that the people that end up coming out to join these coalitions are some of the best members of our society. I mean, they are just smart, committed, funny, creative, and these are the kinds of people that I would want to have by my side fighting any kind of battle. So I encourage people that are in any way feeling defeated by this crisis to turn that sort of intention to mourn into an organizing intention and to really seek out like-minded folks, because they will energize you and keep you going in your darkest hours. And a lot of us are feeling the grief around this. I know I've felt it for quite some time, but there are signs that people are really beginning to get it and are really getting mobilized. For example, I'm working with the National Unitarian General Assembly that's gathering in Portland, and 6,000 members of the Unitarian faith are coming from all over the United States, and they'll be focused exclusively on both climate change and also how best to work in solidarity with Native Americans in facing down this crisis. It's very exciting. It feels like we are going to go back to our home communities and really commit to respond. In fact, there's a website, Commit to Respond, and people are going to be asked to do something along the same lines of what your last guest asked us to do, which is to mobilize towards a World War II-type mobilization to save humanity. I think a lot of us recognize that that's what's required at this point in time, and we need all of us to be calling for the same thing, both for our economy and for our planet, if we're going to stop this monster in time.
Our guest Daphne Wysham hosted the environmental program Earthbeat for 8 years on the Pacifica Radio Network. Now she's bounced between regional activism on the West Coast and her continuing watch over national and international climate developments. She is the director of Climate and the Energy Program at the Center for Sustainable Economy. Daphne, where are the best places to follow your ongoing work?
Sustainable-economy is our website, and we are getting our climate and energy program up and running there. We're very excited about a new initiative that you can see an update on shortly called Climate Risk Bonds. We have our preliminary paper up there, and we'll be posting a lot of our activity on LNG and other oil and gas and coal exports in the Pacific Northwest. We've hired a new political director. You can join our activist network there, and we look forward to engaging with anyone who wants to preserve what we call the thin green line here in the Pacific Northwest to prevent these massive fossil fuel exports from going forward.
Great. So listeners, just Google Center for Sustainable Economy or look for links in my blog at ecoshock.info. Daphne, thank you so much for joining us again. Please keep in touch as you develop more stories.
Thank you. And just one last thing, the easiest website, SEEN.org, will take you right to, SEEN.org, will take you right to our activist network page.
Beautiful, SEEN.org. I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock.
Radio EcoShock.
In the short time we have left, I'd like to pass on some quotes and notes from a deep and important talk from Climate Week at Harvard University Center for the Environment. The speaker is Dr. James Anderson, and the title is Coupled Feedbacks in the Climate Structure That Set the Time Scale for Irreversible Change, Arctic Isotopes to Stratospheric Radicals. That's quite a bit, and believe me, he covers a lot. This talk on April 8, 2015 was part of a series of presentations. I found this on Vimeo thanks to a tip from a Radio EcoShock listener, and I'm so glad I did. The talk, as Anderson tells us, is a fairly high level, a presentation of ongoing research into some important developments in the climate. Anderson covers a wide range of science. I can only get to a few points here. For example, research into past ages showed the stratosphere, that upper level of Earth's atmosphere above the weather, was far wetter than today in past greenhouse ages. The wetting of the stratosphere should be happening now, but until very recently, nobody knew how that could happen. Now we do. Anderson also points out a key difference between past hothouse worlds and today. This time around, humans have also injected chlorinated substances like ozone-destroying CFCs that were never there in the past ages. And how does that affect climate change? As we'll hear from this opening quote, scientists are gaining new knowledge on changes we've made that cannot be reversed, at least not in any time scale that matters to humans. Here is Dr. Anderson speaking at Harvard.
This is really a research talk about two aspects of the climate structure, both of which are coupled through irreversible connective cycles. And so I'm going to talk about experiments done 5 meters above the surface, and then experiments done 20 kilometers above the surface. And you'll see why those are linked. But just in case I skip over these things, I want to emphasize some points. The first one is that this global climate structure is changing far more rapidly than we believed was possible even 5 years ago. And I'm going to show some dominant examples of that. The next issue is the feedbacks within the climate structure, because it's these feedbacks that set the timescale for irreversibility. And I'm going to take a very brief tour through the climate system to demonstrate how that functions. Then I'm going to look at the way in which developing technology provides direct measurements, for example, of methane and carbon dioxide isotopic flux measurements.
Next, we'll hear about how the fragile Arctic determines so much of our weather.
Then I'm going to look at why these cryosystems, which are so delicate because the heat of fusion for water is so small, that the delicacy of these cryosystems, in a cruel irony, link into the larger global climate structure, and they exhibit inordinate control over these global climate systems. I'm going to touch very briefly on this paleo record. And as Brian talked about on Tuesday, the climate structure depends in large measure on the temperature gradient between the tropics and the polar regions. And during the Eocene, there was very little temperature difference between the tropics and the polar regions. And in that particular structure, the stratosphere had to be wet. There's very little. In fact, I don't think there's any possibility of having that climate structure without a moist stratosphere. And as we'll see, moisture entering the stratosphere today has a very different connotation because it triggers catalytic cycles involving chlorine and bromine that were not present during the Eocene. So I'll also talk about deep convective injection north of the subtropical jet, which, as we saw from Brian's talk, is a potential way of transitioning from the current structure of the climate to one in which there is a far smaller difference in temperature between the equator and the polar regions. So this convective injection of water turns out to be unique over the U.S., and it's coupled also to anticyclonic flow over the U.S. that's created by the North American monsoon. And so we have this convective injection into this anticyclonic motion, which is a demonic combination created by the dynamics, but it has very strong coupling into the catalytic chemical structure of the stratosphere.
Note how Anderson stressed the point made again and again by our guest scientist Paul Beckwith when explaining the new disruption of weather in the Northern Hemisphere, and that's the temperature difference between the tropics and the poles. As polar regions warm up, the difference is declining, and the result is a slower and wavier jet stream and some really strange weather for all of us in the northern world. As a side note, Anderson explains why both the left and the right may support further research into controversial geoengineering. First, he refers to the National Research Council report on climate engineering, particularly solar radiation management.
The National Research Council has just released a new report on climate engineering, particularly solar radiation management, that is being pushed actually in a bipartisan way because the right would like to have solar radiation management so more fossil fuels can be burned, and the left believes that intruding in natural systems like this is a very dangerous venture. So research on the topic is gaining bilateral support, which is highly unusual these days.
Next, we hear why James Anderson thinks global warming is so horribly wrong as a term to describe the current climate shift.
All right, so let me start with a bias. This term global warming applied to this problem makes me shudder because 70% of the globe is covered by ocean with an average depth of 3,500 meters, and it has massive heat capacity. So in my mind, the most degenerate variable you can discuss is mean global temperature. And it also carries this connotation of something that's happening slowly. You know, 1 degree centigrade per century doesn't carry a huge amount of political imperative behind it. It also carries the connotation that you can watch things slowly change, and then if you don't like it, you can just slow down the release of carbon dioxide and return to the condition. And nothing could be further from the truth, as we'll see. So I always avoid the term, and I cringe every time I hear it.
We'll never have time to get to all the great science in this talk, but I do want you to hear this.
The next point involves these methane clathrates. These are these beautiful structures, ice cages, within which nature inserts methane produced anaerobically by decomposition of organic material. And it's entropy that's driving this entirely, because nature, of course, abhors a vacuum. You want to stuff molecules into every possible nook and cranny in order to engage the inclusion of energy states. And it turns out that methane fits beautifully into these water cages. And this is ubiquitous. Methane clathrates contain about three times the chemical energy of all known fossil fuel reserves, including coal, petroleum, and natural gas. And they reside not only in the surface soils of Siberia and northern Alaska, but also they're ubiquitous across the ocean basins. This was pulled up off the west coast from about 100 meters, and you just touch a match to it, and it ignites. But the numbers, as Steve Wasey pointed out, are actually quite concerning. So here we plot the CO2 emission from fossil fuel burning in gigatons of carbon per year. So you have to convert back from CO2, but the canonical representation is in carbon per year, because that's typically how it's calibrated. So in 1990, about 6 gigatons of carbon was added to the atmosphere by fossil fuel burning. And that was basically a textbook number for many, many years. But in 2000, it started to take off. And when the 2007 IPCC report came out, these were the release scenarios. This was the worst possible case, this upper red line. And, of course, we've exceeded it every year subsequent to 2007. But the key point is that just 0.5% of the labile carbon in the surface soils of the North Slope of Alaska and Siberia, just 0.5% release rate per year gives us around 8 to 9 gigatons per year, which doubles the carbon added to the atmosphere by all fossil fuel burning worldwide. And so this constitutes the next exhibit for feedbacks.
As I say, there is a huge range of cutting science in this talk by James Anderson. We learn of feedbacks which make this developing climate shift into a major geological event that cannot be reversed. We have already gone over the climate cliff, he tells us. How far we fall depends on whether we can rein in our fossil fuel burning emissions before they trigger much, much larger carbon or methane inputs from the previously frozen lands and seabed in the Arctic. Find an easy link to this Vimeo presentation at Harvard University, April 8, 2015, in my show blog at ecoshock.info. We've blown through the time barrier again. Get all our past programs as free MP3s from our website at ecoshock.org. Listen anytime on the Radio EcoShock page on SoundCloud. I'm Alex. Thank you for listening and caring about our world.